Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And welcome back to the Angry History Podcast. You know, about liking us when we're angry, I think the idea is hopefully the listeners will like us when we're angry. But you know what? You know who doesn't like me when I'm angry? My family. Most of my friends.
That's not true.
That's true. Maybe not. So, Dean, what are we on this week?
This week, we are going to do the 10 greatest things our presidents never said. Now, there are many misquotes, but we decided we would pick 10 for President's Day, and people are talking about them a lot on Facebook and such, and we see these quotes, and it's one of the things that make us angry when we know it's something someone didn't say.
Absolutely. This whole false quote thing, it's always been there, but lately, because of stupid internet and massive social media juggernauts like Macebook or whatever it's called, I don't know if we can call it by its real name. People do it for various reasons. And often it's after the person has died. It's like, hey, you know what? Mom died. Oh, gosh, that's horrible. Yeah. And she told me she loved me best. Or she went.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something. Dead people always agree with you. You ever notice that? Like nobody ever says, you know, I was thinking last night that if Winston Churchill was here today, he would tell me I was being a real jackass.
No, it's always, other than Winston Churchill and I having so much in common, he really would have agreed with me on this
yeah.
one. So, we're going to do the top 10 here, and let's just get started right away with one that's attributed to George Washington, the father of our country, Mr. Dollar Bill.
Washington, Washington.
And here he was supposedly explaining...
Our bicameral legislature, that's the House and Senate.
He'll kick you apart. He'll kick you apart. Ooh.
To Thomas Jefferson. And the quote is this. We pour our legislation into the senatorial saucer to cool it. End quote. End false quote. What is this?
Yeah, that's supposedly him talking to Jefferson. And I actually almost chose another Washington quote. And then I actually got scared that I almost missed my chance to complain about how horrible this quote is and how much it really makes me angry. Because it's just such a ridiculous scene.
It's dumb sounding. It doesn't even come out of your mouth. It's senatorial saucer. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and Jefferson wasn't an idiot, for one thing.
Right.
He was a smart guy. He knew what a bicameral legislature was, and he actually told the Marquis de Lafayette that he supported it.
Love that guy, by the way.
Yeah, he knew what was going on. He had a lot of people to talk to. He could have talked to James Madison, the father of the Constitution, who was his protege, about this if he had questions. And my final thing is, nobody pours coffee into a saucer and then pours it back in. Have you ever done that? Am I wrong?
No, not even back in ye old days did they do it.
No, that's not how you'd scald yourself. I mean, Washington wouldn't because he was so tough.
No, he was awesome. And it's also, people think he was like 6'2". He was actually 75 feet tall.
He was, yeah.
He was.
Washington, Washington, 12 stories high, made of radiation. The present beware, the future beware. He's coming, he's coming, he's coming.
Before we go any further on this whole notion of dead people make great communicators, we definitely have to give a shout out to Ralph Keyes from the Quote Verifier for that. And I think his quote was, famous dead people make excellent commentators on current events. And he is so right. So thank you, Mr. Keyes.
And we should also thank the people at the Theodore Roosevelt Association.
Mm-hmm.
They put up a quote that was a little confusing, and they jumped right on it to fix it when we pointed it out.
These people act as the gatekeepers to the memories of these men. And for them to have responded so quickly and so kind of awesomely about it was great. We love them. We're both members, full disclosure.
Yeah, and so should you be, all of you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And get out to Sagamore Hill next time you're in New York. Go out to Oyster Bay and see where the man lived and wow, how he lived.
Yep, they're renovating it right now, actually. So check on the website for when they finish it. My wife and I were actually able to go in there and see it while they were doing the work, but that's something you usually don't get to do.
No, and that was my first visit there was with you and Kathy.
That's right. Yeah.
And what a great day that was. It really was something else. And the Greek food in Queens later was awesome, too. All right, let's move on to number two here. And this is Washington's Veep, our second president, John Adams. And his misquote is, one-third supported the revolution, one-third opposed it, and one-third had no opinion. Go!
This is a pretty simple mishearing. This isn't a malicious one or just kind of a silly one like the Washington quote complaining about the Senate moving slowly.
Right.
It's basically a mishearing, a paraphrase of something John Adams wrote to James Lloyd in 1813. But the key phrase is the revolution or the war.
Now let me cut you off. Who is James Lloyd?
James Lloyd was a friend of his that he was writing to at the time.
Okay.
And so he was over there and he said, what are the Americans thinking of the revolution right now in France? And so Adams wrote back and he just said, well, the revolution, here's how Americans feel about it. A third of them, you know, are the yeomanry in there. They don't want to get pulled into it. They really don't take a dog in this fight.
Right.
And there's a third who are still really mad at Britain because we just fought them. But then there's a third that sort of say, well, you know, France was the ancient enemy we grew up hating when we were British. And even though we're independent now, we still are mad at the French. We don't particularly like them,
right.
Which is probably about what you'd find now, again, for any given country. And so that was just a mishearing of it. And I had gone to the 92nd Street Y again with my wife. And it was a question that I submitted to David McCullough. And he addressed it. And it was a cool thing because you saw a lot of people in there really surprised, because you hear this all the time that, oh, well, people were divided in the revolution and nobody really wanted it, but it wasn't the case.
And when you stop and you pull this quote apart, it really doesn't even make a lot of sense, you know?
No, it doesn't. You think about it, we fought a guerrilla war and you need popular support for that. As Mao said, the guerrilla swims in the populace and that's where they hide and need support, you need food. And the way we fought the British, it's pretty clear if you think about it for a minute that we definitely didn't have a third of the people apathetic and a third for the war and a third against. It just doesn't, a third of us couldn't have made it happen.
Right, right. And actually, it's funny, you mentioned about how he was writing, President Adams was writing to Lloyd in this case. A lot of what we know about our presidents and a lot of figures in history comes from their letters. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think the great thing about the Adamses, all of them really, is they were picked apart so much by people. They also picked on themselves. John Adams was famous for criticizing himself as vain. And he said, I don't have the energy. We don't have men equal to these times. I shouldn't even be here, basically.
Right.
And yet they were fair in their writing. And the things that we know about a guy like Andrew Jackson is because John Quincy Adams wrote so much about him.
Right.
The founding fathers burned a lot of them. Washington burned all of his papers. And so don't make the Adamses mad because they're the ones who have the final say, but they're pretty fair. They criticize themselves and they criticize other people, but they're pretty fair. In fact, Andrew Jackson was shocked to learn after he'd had this big feud with Adams, everyone was whispering to him and saying, Adams is the one that told us to throw you under the bus for invading Florida. And John Quincy Adams was like, I'm not going to go explain myself to that guy.
Right.
And he found out later, Jackson said, he read the minutes of the meeting and he said, my gosh, Secretary of State Adams is the only one who was standing up for my ass.
Right.
And
these guys were not pals.
No. And that was one of the reasons. Originally, John Quincy Adams wanted him to be his vice president, this and that.
Right.
But some people got a hold of him and said, oh, he's bad-mouthing you. He was the one who sold you out in Florida. The Monroe administration, after it, everybody always coveted Florida. And they basically just let this crazy Jackson guy loose on the border. And they're like, well, let's see what'll happen. It's like, yeah, okay. It's like, you know, leaving a wild Wolverine into a KFC. You know, he's going to get into the bucket.
Yeah. There are a lot of people in this country who are asking themselves what happened after Jackson.
Yeah.
Particularly those who were taking a trip across the Mississippi.
The only reason he didn't take Cuba is finally his body decided, after being shot and having malaria and, you know, smallpox and fish paralyzer and everything else that he had, it just finally kind of gave out. You know, he just stopped short, or else
right.
Imagine how history would be different.
I know. That's an awesome show for another time. All right. Hey, let's move on to number three here. And this is, we're continuing a trend here. This is Adams Veep.
Well, we're moving on up.
Thomas Jefferson, and his quote is, I like my coffee like I like my women. Go. No, it's not it. It's, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We can knock this one out pretty quickly, I think. I'm sure for people listening to it right now, if you're paying any kind of attention, it sounds Just a little too perfect.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of things that are wrong with this one that, as I said, we can knock out pretty quickly. First of all,
right.
Whenever they have anachronisms, like the Lincoln joke quote on Facebook, having him talk about the internet.
Right.
The term deflation didn't appear in the Oxford Dictionary till 1920.
Dean, when did this made up quote appear?
111 years after his death, actually, in a congressional report, which is nice to see them saying stuff on Congress. And there's a few of those like this.
Right.
The late Senator Robert Byrd actually passed on that Washington anecdote that we talked about earlier. Usually they'll preface it by "so the story goes," but on ones like this, this really got people worked up. And the fact that it's completely wrong, we didn't have a corporation in this country. The first one was 1813, the Boston Manufacturing Company. So this just wasn't an issue back then.
Right.
And it's a silly quote. And even though it might go along with what some people think, it doesn't work just because it's Jefferson. We should come up with our own persuasive things.
Right. Right. Okay. All right. So let us move on to number four. And this is our sixth president, son of the second, John Quincy Adams. Back to him now.
Well, gentlemen, I must say I differ with the keen minds of the South. And with our president, who apparently shares their views, offering that the natural state of mankind is instead, and I know this is a controversial idea, is freedom. Is freedom. And the proof is the length to which a man, woman, or child will go to regain it once taken. He will break loose his chains. He will decimate his enemies. He will try and try and try against all odds, against all prejudices, to get home.
That's actually Anthony Hopkins. We don't have any real audio of John Quincy Adams. That's some of their version in the movie of his Amistad speech, which actually went on for many hours. And it gives you kind of an idea of what his feelings were on freedom and that kind of thing, leading up to the famous case of the Africans that took over their slave ship and just wanted to go home.
And his misquote is, "The highest glory of the American Revolution was this. It connected in one indissoluble bond the principles of civil government with the principles of Christianity," end quote. This sounds like another one almost, you know, ready-made for today.
Yes, this was, and it's also another one that is a misreading, mishearing, not seeing the quotation marks. This is actually by a gentleman named John Wingate Thornton, and it was his opinion of what John Quincy Adams thought about Christianity. Now, you take this out of his 1860 book. Again, this is long after JQA is dead.
Right.
The Pulpit of the American Revolution. And he's talking about it and describing it. Yes, he was a man of faith, John Quincy Adams. He was a Unitarian like his father. And you know what those Unitarians are like. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, that's the question. I don't know what they're like. And there's that terrible old joke is, do you hear about the Unitarians moved into a new neighborhood and someone burned a question mark on their lawn? Sorry, Unitarian friends. I say that with the utmost respect and recognition of context.
And there's even a book about John Quincy Adams, the letters he wrote to his son about the Bible and its teachings. But this is just not something he said. It's somebody's opinion after he's dead. And I can tell anybody anything once you're dead that you told me in confidence or whatnot.
Right.
And these quotes pop up a lot, but it was not something that he said. And it certainly wasn't delivered on July 4th, which eventually, old man eloquent, they claimed that this was a July 4th. 1821 speech, an Independence Day speech. It just wasn't anything of the kind. So we knock that one out.
Very good. Very good.
Captain Kirk, I believe. A pleasure to make your acquaintance, sir.
Uhura.
No need to check your voice telegraph device. Do I gather that you recognize me?
I recognize what you appear to be.
And appearances can be most deceiving. But not in this case, James Kirk. I am Abraham Lincoln.
And there is actual historical archival audio of our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. Don't believe me? Are you going to call him a liar? Are you going to call Kirk a liar? All right, go ahead. I don't think so. Moving on. Here is the quote, the misquote from Mr. $5 Bill. "If this nation is to be destroyed, it will be destroyed from within. If it is not destroyed from within, it will live for all time to come." Isn't that a nice
Yeah,
thing?
Lincoln is a favorite. This one is sort of taken out of the speech he gave in 1838 to the Young Men's Lyceum in Springfield, Illinois. But he wasn't really writing something for posterity here. He was clearly talking about the Civil War when he talked in this. And he talked about, shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step over the ocean and crush us a blow? Never. And he talks about all these eloquent things about how all the armies of Europe couldn't take a drink from the Ohio River if we wanted to stop them. But he wasn't right. talking about all the way down the road here, and it wasn't some ominous thing about a fifth column. Just like his anti-prohibition quote that he never said was used widely. Actually, a Georgia wet leader who was mayor of Atlanta before and after made up a quote about Lincoln saying that prohibition was bad because he wanted to encourage newly freed African Americans. But this time it's 1887, so it's 20 years after the Civil War, and you have a lot of black Americans voting. And he just wanted to turn them out to vote. Right. So he said, hey, look, Lincoln was against prohibition. This guy was Colonel John B. Goodwin. He just made up this quote, and some guy decided he would try to track it down. And this is way, way before the internet. I mean, this is 1887. And he managed to force the guy to admit that he just made it up. And then he got elected mayor again anyway, so things don't change.
Well, you know, America has an interesting history with mayors who keep getting elected. Marion Barry, Bloomberg.
But... we should have burned it down again, but that's just... teach him.
I haven't perfected my resurrect Sherman spell yet, but I'm working on it. All right, Rutherford B. Hayes, our 19th president. There's another interesting connection here with a past president and our current one, President Obama.
You know, one of my predecessors, Rutherford B. Hayes, reportedly said about the telephone, it's a great invention, but who would ever want to use one?
So tell us about Rudd.
This one you probably heard a lot about out there if you were watching any news then, because you'd be surprised that a lot of people jumped out of the woodwork here to defend Rutherford B. Hayes. Think about Jimmy Carter when he was elected, if you're old enough to remember that.
I am.
Rutherford B. Hayes is a full 100 years before that. He's the centennial president, elected in 1876, and even that was a disputed election. So he took a real long time. I don't think they decided that he was going to be president until as late as 3 days before the inauguration. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty long, drawn-out thing. So a lot of people stood up for him, and other than Fremont, Ohio, where his great presidential center is, the only place that he just really remembered today is Paraguay.
Really?
There's actually a Villa Hayes. Yeah, there's a Villa Hayes. There's a Presidente Hayes province. He has a soccer team named in his honor. I think they're called the Yankees.
Oh, that's funny.
November 12th is a public holiday. He has they just love him. He did an arbitration for the country in 1878, and he gave them 60% of their land that's currently Paraguay. So he redrew their map, and
wow.
There's also a cute story of this girl who won a TV show contest to be sent. She's only 17. And her dream was to go to the Hayes Center in Fremont, Ohio. And this Paraguayan TV show paid for it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But as for this quote, the issue of the telephone is not really true. They tried to sort of slip in that little reportedly said, which is the speechwriter there just covering their ass. The story sounds too good not to be rhetorically. But Rutherford B. Hayes actually had the first telephone installed in the White House.
I've got to ask, what was the number?
One. It was actually one, yeah. The book is The Telephone Comes to Washington by Richard T. Loomis. And yeah, his number was one. That was it. You'd pick up the phone, dial one, and it's still the same number today. So Obama should have known that.
He should have. It'd be like this. Imagine back then, it's like you have Siri, you just go, one. Or dial, you know, hey, President Hayes, how are you?
And the answer,
I'm from the future.
Do they still have sandwiches there?
Exactly. Have you ever, what do you think about Paraguay?
He thought about it very little. That's the weird thing. He never really went there. That probably took like 10 minutes of his day, they'll tell you, at the Hayes Library.
Right.
Yeah, but they really appreciate it. So, hey, why not? I'm sure he'll take Villa Hayes and the soccer team and all the other stuff and the stamp that he's on. And it's awesome for him.
That's great. All right, now, number 7.
Sing the line, ladies and gentlemen. Line forms here to meet the President of the United States. Sing a line to shake hands with President William McKinley.
This is your second favorite president after President Wilson, right? This is McKinley. You know, there are sometimes advantages to being 3,000 miles away from you, and that is that you can't strike me right now. Dean hates Wilson, loves President McKinley. Let's just put it that way.
I don't hate any of our fine presidents.
Yes, you do.
Have I micturated on President Wilson's grave? That's why he got buried in the National Cathedral.
Exactly. Let's just put it this way. When we go to the closest that a lot of us have to a cathedral to history in New York, McSorley's, you do not like to sit under Wilson's photograph.
No, I try to avoid it. Well, he deported Emma Goldman, and thank God we had T.R. able to speak out still because everybody else was too afraid to. He really crushed civil rights in World War One.
He was a prince. Great leather goods, though. All right, William McKinley, our 25th president, and who was Rutherford B. Hayes' protege. And this was supposedly on the Philippines. The major said, quote, There was nothing left for us to do but take them all and educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them, and by God's grace do the very best we could by them as our fellow men for whom Christ also died. End quote. Now, what is the deal on this one? This is another, it seems, just loaded with strange buzzwords that sort of don't quite ring true to the time or the man.
Yeah, this was a really long quote, which you can see at angryhistory.com. And if you look at it and you know anything about the major, you know, McKinley just didn't speak like that to people. People would go see him. They would leave thinking, oh, he heard me out. I think he agrees with me. But he wasn't the kind of guy who would talk a whole lot about what he was thinking at length like this. He certainly never used the word Christianize, which wasn't even in wide use back then.
Right.
He wasn't the kind of guy who said God told me to do things. For another point on this,
yeah,
Aaron Morton, who ministered to McKinley, said he, quote, was not what you would call a shouting Methodist, but one that was careful with his words. And okay. He said the loving kindness of God was McKinley's religion, which I thought was a fantastic way to describe somebody. We should all want somebody to say that about us and not have to get shot twice in the chest, of course.
Jeez, gosh, yeah.
He was devoid of bigotry, all this kind of stuff. There's a lot to say about this one because it's so long.
Spain had sort of done the Christianizing already. I mean, it was Catholic Spain had been there for 400 years already, right?
Yeah, 1565 they'd gotten there. And in Sarah Vowell's book, Assassination Vacation, she points that out, but doesn't really stop to think, well, McKinley would have known that because at the time, one of the reasons people wanted to go to war with Spain over Cuba was this notion of freeing Cuba from the Catholic Church, something it's hard for us to relate to today. We talk about it with JFK, but we don't really think of how much anti-Catholic sentiment that there was. So he would have known that. And also the man who told this story, who wrote it down, didn't really tell the story at all.
Right.
At the time that he claims it happened. His name was General James F. Rustling. The story supposedly happens in 1899, right? McKinley dies in 1901. Rustling doesn't tell this story until 1903,
right.
And a report that General Rustling had written about Abraham Lincoln in 1899 was very similar to this. A president falling to his knees in the White House, asking for divine guidance. It's all kind of the same stuff. Striking is the word Richard F. Hamilton uses in President McKinley, War and Empire. General Rustling either plagiarized himself or maybe a letter by a gentleman named Spencer Borden in July of 1898, which laid out the same case for why we should take the Philippines and keep them as a territory. So all those things add up to being very suspicious. And McKinley was dead by this point and couldn't defend himself.
And what happens here, too, is you have an instance where you talk about President Lincoln, you know, on his knees begging for guidance. Then he was killed for his cause. Then you have President McKinley on his knees begging for guidance, killed for his cause. This is the story of Christ. And you're applying a Christ-like example to a largely Christian nation to try to push something down their throats.
Yes, it's a great point, because at the time of his death, McKinley, who's largely forgotten today outside of the people in Canton, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and in Niles, Ohio, that have libraries and his memorial where he's interred, people forget.
Sure.
They just know, oh, he was a president. In this case, people use it quite negatively to talk about the war in Iraq. And he was never that kind of guy. Lincoln wasn't that kind of guy. And to put words in their mouths and to either lift them up or push them down isn't something that we should be doing after they're martyred, especially. McKinley was considered the most popular president since Lincoln. And there were a lot of Lincoln comparisons, especially after he died. People just loved him. He was loved all across all the sections. He reunited us after the Civil War. And so that was the reason behind this metaphor, I would say, is that everybody wanted him to have been Lincoln, and they just deified him, and they put a lot of words in his mouth that sound bad today.
And isn't also part of that putting words in his mouth, he didn't have as many letters published, say, as other presidents. Is that true, or am I mixing that up with someone else?
No, he was pretty limited. He didn't write a lot down. He had a diary that he kept when he was in the Civil War
right.
for a brief period, but not a lot of conversation written. He preferred to keep things in his head.
Right.
And that's why today people think, oh, well, he didn't really read much. He was well read. He memorized poems. He read a lot of newspapers. He named his parrot the Washington Post, which people always find amusing. But he got shot, so you don't have time to sit and write your memoirs. He was relatively young when he was assassinated.
Right.
He had 3 more years left. He would have written when he got out, like Grant did.
You know, folks listening to this, as we continue with Angry History, and you're going to hear a lot about President McKinley, because he really is. Dean does love him with good reason, and he's taught me an awful lot about him. And you don't happen to have any memorabilia by any chance, do you?
You're just making me a parody now of somebody who's...
No, I
do happen to be wearing a McKinley Library shirt, but I just grabbed it out of the drawer.
Nice. As long as you don't have your Leon Schulgas, I'm with stupid shirt on, so, with the arrow pointing up.
Who'd want to kill a man of goodwill like
Big Bill?
Doesn't the president look marvelous? So round and prosperous.
Do you know what his favorite dish is? It was in the papers. Beef.
We will get to McKinley more and more, his amazing relationship with his wife, who was quite ill, and he was just a hell of a guy. A hinge president at a fascinating time. All right, moving on.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
Number 8, FDR, Dean's second favorite president after Wilson.
I've told you, if you're going to be a fan of the Roosevelts, you have to choose between Oyster Bay and Hyde Park. And I like a president can take a walk on the beach.
I'll see you in hell. Okay, here's the quote. In politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way. End quote. And of course, what you're listening to before was Happy Days Are Here Again, which was used by FDR in his 1932 campaign. Anyway, so what is the deal with this quote? This is not one of those insane ones that was just pulled from whole cloth. He did say something similar to this, right, during a speech?
Yeah, it's kind of another one of those where people decide they're going to summarize it down.
Right.
I mentioned Emma Goldman before, and a famous one of hers is, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be in your evolution," which is distilling down something that she actually said, but that's not fair to use as a quote. Now, this one doesn't sound very insidious today, but at the time, people took a speech that FDR gave at the Citadel in 1935, where he was saying, look, people are saying now, oh, sure, we're coming out of the Great Depression, but it's just a coincidence. And this is an argument you probably still hear ongoing today if you listen or read any history. And he was saying, no, we didn't just come out of it by chance. It's not a business cycle. It's because we planned it, and he was taking credit for it, basically. And there was actually a book written called None Dare Call a Conspiracy that proceeds to call it a conspiracy. And Frank Knox, who was the 1936 Republican vice presidential candidate under Alf Landon, used the phrase, "We planned it that way," to attack the New Deal in a 1938 pamphlet. And it was that idea that they sort of took way out of context and twisted and added things to say this. And today it sounds like, oh, just a quaint little thing. But again, if you think about it for 2 seconds, everybody knows mistakes happen in politics. Just ask any congressman recently who's tweeted a naked picture of themselves to somebody. You know, of course, accidents happen all the time.
I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. Now the heavenly blisses of his kisses fills me with ecstasy. That's just a rough idea, you understand. He's the sweetest chocolate candy, and just like honey from a bee. Oh, I'm just wild about Harry, and he's wild about, cannot do without. He is from the south. Can't you hear me shout, talking with my mouth? Could you ever doubt, he's just wild about me?
Wild about Harry. Indeed. This was written in 1921 for Broadway's first successful play with black writers and cast, and it broke a taboo against romantic love. Truman used it as his campaign song in 1948. Give him hell, Harry. So here is the quote. If you want a friend in Washington, get a dog.
Yes, this is one probably will shock a lot of people because you hear it so often. But it's another quote that did not appear until after he died in 1972. Nobody was talking about it before. His daughter, Margaret Truman, actually wrote a book called White House Pets. And you would think that would have been front cover material if her father had said this adorable thing.
Right.
I've been to the Truman Library and Museum, where he and Bess Truman are buried, out in Independence, Missouri, and to his house. And I had actually called them when Bill Clinton got his dog Buddy and brought him in his first dog, just to kind of verify this, because I worked for a pet show at the time and I knew that it wasn't a quote. And there's no record of him saying it. It sort of pops up a lot. The Irish Independent is my favorite one, where they say, as Truman used to say, as if he was out evangelizing for people to get dogs.
Yeah. Well, as Truman used to say, no, he didn't.
Yeah, well, they make an interesting point at the Truman National Historic Site, where they say farm dogs for Truman were really about it. And in those days, you had a dog because it worked. You had an animal on the farm, like you had a cow, or you had a barn cat, because they did jobs. And if you think about his public image, I can see where he probably wasn't a coochie-coochie little sleeve dog puppy guy, and he didn't have a dog. They don't know where this came from, but it just sort of got attached to him after he died.
It's odd, too. I mean, this is, you know, he's a practically a modern era president. It's always surprising, too. It's like, wow, he died in 72, alive then.
Yeah.
It's an odd little thought.
Back then, the only version of the Facebook post was those motivational posters we used to have.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Remember those? Yeah. Well, what was the big one? I remember my aunt had one in her room.
Keep on trucking.
Keep on trucking. Yeah, there was that. And today is the first day of the rest of your life. And I spent entirely too much time trying to figure that one out. All right, let's go to number 10. This is JFK, our 35th president. Let's have the man speak the words himself.
2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was, Civis Romanus sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
So, supposedly, instead of saying what anyone who speaks English could probably get, he's saying, I'm a Berliner. I'm a Berliner. Now, what the story is that he's actually saying, I'm a jelly donut, which is just, I mean, this actually does get me aggravated. It's like willful stupidity on the part of people who want to get behind this one.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dean. What do you got on this?
It's sort of similar to the idea of putting the quote in the mouth of a great man that you want to use for your own ends, whereas this is the flip side where you say, well, we want to take this guy down a couple pegs and it sounds like a funny little story, and so we'll sort of say he was not too bright, but it's just not the case. It's not the case, for instance, with Jimmy Carter. He once was on a late night show and he said his translator had told the Polish people that President Carter said they had a great lust for freedom. Now, Carter had said love of freedom.
Right.
And to the Polish people, as Mr. Carter explained it, they basically translated that as the Polish people had a long history of free love, as we would call it.
How weird.
To his credit, I guess, he didn't fire the translator. He was a man, the translator, who was more familiar with Russian than Polish. Whereas JFK, in this case, he not only had a man there who was a person born and raised in Berlin, but he ran it by an assistant to the mayor of West Berlin and by the mayor, Willy Brandt himself. So one of these guys would have said, oh, hey, wait a minute, you're saying you're a jelly donut.
Right.
But unfortunately, there was an April 1988 column where the author kind of pushed this notion. It was actually called I Am a Jelly-Filled Donut. This man, William J. Miller, just pushed that notion. And it's too bad because he starts off saying, putting words in a president's mouth or attributing fabricated quotes may on occasion be preferable to having a president utter clever words dreamed up by speechwriters. So that sounds like it's kind of right what we're saying here. And then he sort of veers off into this. And we talked to somebody actually at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library, Stacey Chandler, and she sent us the pictures of JFK's actual notes where he is going over the pronunciation. And even in the speech, if you listen, because he says it again later, he thanks his translator for translating his German,
right,
meaning his German wasn't so hot, but they translated it into German anyway. And so that's, you know, it's pretty clear. It's a funny little thing, but
right,
it's sort of a regional idea, if you think about it, like the way some of us might say pop or soda or Coke in the United
or
States.
Or a hero or a grinder, you know.
Right, yeah, or a submarine. Oh, I'm hungry now.
Now I am too, and I'm angry because it reminds me that I'm west of the Rockies, and we don't have Hellman's out here. We have Best Foods. It's one of those things. You know what? My day's been ruined. Go ahead. Just finish. sorry. I'm not that angry.
No, but the thing is, this is really not a transcription mistake. It's not a translation mistake.
No.
And it's not, even though people in West Berlin wouldn't call the donuts that, they call them actually just literally pancakes in their language.
Right.
And Germany just was a country. Don't forget, they were surrounded.
Yeah.
And they were separated from the rest of Germany. And it's, like I said, it's just a little regional thing. And somebody just unfortunately picked it up. And now it's been on CNN, MSNBC, BBC, all over the place. To me, the most telling thing is, if you listen to the clip, the crowd in Berlin goes crazy with applause. They're not laughing. There's no awkward pause. There's nothing. They know exactly what he's saying.
All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
It is a great moment, and it's a terrible thing to steal that from him and to steal it from history. And there's a lot of snide little things like that about history where we want to make fun of people and great things that happen. And I'm all for making fun of things, and so are you. But, you know, when we have great moments, we should respect them and not try to twist their meaning.
But again, somebody, one person's great moment is another person's opportunity just to slag the hell out of someone for whatever differences they have. I mean, this is what we're living every day to the, you know, it's turned up to 11 at this point. I mean, you know, goodness gracious. Can you imagine anyone trying to get anything done if Facebook was around or even the internet was around during the Second World War or, you know, the revolution? Just wouldn't, we just couldn't get things done. It's just,
I can't imagine Bob Crane getting a lot done.
Oh, Bob Crane.
He's your Wilson. Tell the nice people as we close here why you have this hatred for Bob Crane.
Hogan. It's more of a, I don't know, I felt gypped. I felt betrayed by the good people at Disney and by Bob Crane himself. When I was a kid, my Nana took me to see a movie called Super Dad. And back in the mid-70s, long before we had, you know, an awesome Avengers movie, you know, or this great sort of Marvel cinematic universe, you know, you took whatever you could get, you know, and for us, it was reruns of Batman, you know, and it was great. It was color and it was awesome. But, you know, you wanted something cool. You wanted your superhero. So all of a sudden, this movie called Super Dad comes out. I'm like, this is great. It's gonna be Superman in here. Maybe part of the Superman family, you know, and maybe we'll see Crypto. And so my Nana and I go to Kings Plaza in Brooklyn to go see this movie, and the closest thing that there is to anything resembling Superman was Bob Crane walking on the beach with a towel over his shoulders. So yeah, I sort of had a love-hate. I loved Bob Crane because he was a constant thorn in the side to the Nazis. He had to be. He was an officer. It was his duty to try to escape. And also because he shattered my Superman dreams at a very young age, which is, I think, the big takeaway to all this is that this is why Marvel will always be better than DC.
Well, Bob Crane got his.
I guess he did.
wait, were you ever questioned?
No, I was too young. I remember that, actually. I was actually at my Nana's house years later, and on the news that Saturday, Bob Crane found in the condition that he was.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Sounds like a good place to put a Family Guy clip.
The German environmental minister called a press conference to issue the following statement.
I see nothing. I know nothing.
Well, listen, these are just 10 of many, many, many misquotes. And again, we decided to do presidents just because, you know, it was on our minds. And Dean is our go-to guy for presidential history and more than that, passion. Wanted to thank you guys again for tuning in today. No one tuned in. And you know what? It'll take a generation or two before we stop saying things like tuned in. But I'm not going to be the guy to stop saying it.
Bob Crane really threw you off.
Bob Crane, I'm thinking about my Nana, who's been gone for a bunch of years. I'm thinking about Bob Crane, who's been gone even longer. And
they died in similar situations, didn't they? Now I'm happy I'm 3,000 miles away.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, you know, my dad is about 10 miles away from me, so he's probably paying me a visit pretty soon. Hey, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And thank you so much for tuning in today, guys. And we will see you next time on Angry History.
We are the mediocre presidents. You won't find our faces on dollars or on cents. There's Taylor and there's Tyler, there's Fillmore and there's Hayes. There's William Henry Harrison.
I died in 30 days.
We are the adequate, forgettable, occasionally regrettable. There, take your presidents up with you.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.